Hello, welcome. This is the High Tech Craft Panel, Why Sewing and Knitting Still Matter. My name is Natalie Z. Drew, and I'm senior editor of Craft Magazine. Here on the panel joining me is Diana Ng, Susie Pakchin, Allison Lewis, and Muna Andreas. And I've collected these women who are moving at the forefront of this new emergence in the DIY space, do-it-yourself, of crafts moving along with technology, merging with fashion and art. And each of the women are going to introduce themselves and show you some of their projects. Diana, do you want to start?
Sure. Hi, I'm Diana. And you can't hear me very well. Can you hear me better, maybe? Okay, great. Oh, it's off. Hello?
Yeah.
Okay. Hi, I'm Diana. I'm a fashion designer. I was a designer on Project Runway and winner of Yahoo Hack Day with a group of people in 2006. Let's see, here are some of the things I've worked on. This is actually an old wearable before the time of conductive thread. And it's called Heartbeat Hoodie. It has a camera in the hood. And as your heartbeat increases, it takes photographs to document moments of interest. So I was kind of developing the algorithm so that it wouldn't necessarily take photographs when you're like running down the street, but if something catastrophic happens or maybe you're by someone that you're attracted to, it might take a photograph of them.
Can you show it?
Oh, okay.
You can see that.
Yeah, so here it is. Okay. And then this is a jacket that has... that uses mathematics in the design of the ruffle over here. So it has the Fibonacci sequence in it. And by knitting the Fibonacci sequence, it naturally created a spiral, which when attached to the garment creates a ruffle.
Yep. Hi, is this on? Okay, my name is Susie Pakchin from sparklab.la. And I'm an interaction designer, a crafter, a maker, and recently a semi-writer. I'm finishing up currently a book called Fashioning Technology, a DIY Intro to Smart Crafting. And the book's intention is actually intended for a craft audience who have an interest not only in learning how to incorporate and create really simple basic circuits to sort of animate their projects, but also how to learn how to work with smart materials. Anywhere from like photo or thermochromatic inks to knit and all. So the projects range from just interactive toys to wearables as well as objects for the home. I'm going to show a couple of projects that are actually in the book and use that as a platform to discuss some sort of ideas or my sort of philosophy in terms of making. This is a wearable. It's Ariel, the Birdie Brooch. And essentially, Ariel has a custom circuit that can be designed and can be altered, so you can change her song depending on what resistors and capacitors that you use, as well as designing the aesthetics of Ariel the Birdie Brooch. She's powered by a solar panel, so when you wear it outside, since there's no light in here, can you hear it? Okay. She actually starts to chirp
and
make
different
noises.
It's real.
Yeah, it sounds like a little bird. So the thing about this project that to me is fun and interesting is that not only are individuals able to customize the technology, the actual functionality of the technology, give each little project their own personal song or bird voice, but also they can design the aesthetics of the actual printed circuit board. So they learn how to not only etch a printed circuit board, but they also use it as a functionality of what the end product looks like. So technology here is used for both its functional as well as its aesthetic and symbolic purposes. And the next project is there are these interactive puppets. And we've got a couple of different characters. And you know, these, using really simple circuits, everything is made using conductive threads and textiles and little soft switches for their bellies. So, sorry about this. So we've got Blush, who actually blushes, you know, when he gets shy. We've got Spitfire, who's the aggressive one of the group. And then we've got Tremble, who's the little neurotic little character who actually starts to shake. Oops. in trouble once he's nervous, but he's not working at the moment. So these little guys are very simple to make, and the fun thing is that it actually teaches people how to sew and work with technology, but it actually allows a level of animating really simple and ordinary projects. So, okay, thank you.
Hello, hi. I am Allison Lewis. I teach at Parsons School of Design, a class called Fashion Technology. I co-teach it with Sabine Seymour, who's actually writing a book called Fashion Technology. At this time, just took a job doing interactive exhibits for science, history, and children's museums. I get to basically make anything that we can dream up. So it's kind of like a dream job. I, too, also have a book coming out. It is called Switchcraft. It's by Random House, Pottercraft. And I take a little bit different approach. Everything that I've learned for, oh gosh, since I started sewing and crafting, I've kind of put into the book. I take what you can see and find at regular craft stores. I want to find things that people can work with that they're used to working with, like snaps, zippers, trying to get them to look at the things around us in a little bit different way. So I brought two of the projects. One of them got cut from the book, but you guys get to see it. The first thing I like to do, I also do workshops. I forgot to mention that. So I also do workshops as well. The first project I always like to teach everyone, especially girls, is how to make your purse light up when you open it. I might need the lights off for that. Yeah, I showed this at Make last year. My purse did not make it with me, my original, just to show you how easy it was. I bought this, and in 20 minutes, they saw me. I just stuck the little panel in there. Add some switches, and yeah, I'm ready. Ooh, that's very exciting. So then we have like a little light that lights up. Yay! And you can see inside. Okay. And then on the other side, there's a lot of things coming out that are going to be for the home. Everything's going to be sewing. Using the kind of skills that we've already learned as women and craftsmen, I mean, looking at technology in a different way, looking at beads a different way. You know, if you find like silver beads, those are obviously conductive. You can look at them and you can start to use them in your crafting and whatever you want to make, right? So I get really inspired by the skills we already have as crafters. And we're used to working with tiny, small threads and beading things and putting things together in this way that it's really not a big jump. To start learning about technology. And so I'm trying to show that in a different way. So this is a sewn piece. It's a vase. It's movable and adjustable. You can do whatever you want with it. This also has light. The easiest thing normally is light. So sorry. So if you guys want to make some noise. Hello? Can you guys please talk to me? Hi. This is actually, you just buy little kits, and you put the kits together, and I used test tubes. It was done in conjunction with a girl named Allison Connor who works at Frog Design, and we wanted to make something that, you know, you can customize it yourself. I think it's pretty cool. I think what she came up with and we came up together works really nicely for the home. So I'm just out here to try to change the way people talk about technology and the way that we look at it. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Muna. I'm an artist and interaction designer, and I've been working with kind of new media for quite a few years now, and initially doing screen-based work, web and video stuff mostly, and kind of got tired of having to experience technology exclusively through the mouse and the keyboard. So that brought me back into making things and the physicality of things. I spent about the first 20 years of my life fighting with my mother, who kept saying, how can you be a girl and live your own life and you don't even know how to stitch a button? And finally, before going to grad school and realizing the big boom that was going on and getting really excited about seeing crafters and what they were able to do and how they were able to bring in innovative approaches to working with new technologies, I finally called up my mom and said, okay, it's time. I need to learn at 20-some years old how to stitch a button. So started doing that. And I work both as a freelancer and as a designer on my own, and recently ran an online project called thingaday.com, where we invited people to just go through a collective creative process together, where you just kind of spend a few minutes, 20 minutes, an hour a day, getting something done and putting it out there. And thanks to Craft Magazine, actually, and Craft Blog, it got to a big, really big group of crafters involved in the project, and it was very exciting for me to kind of get a little bit closer to that community, understand what they worked. So, and project I built on. So, as a designer, one of the things I really wanted to tackle was to rethink a little bit about the impact that all of these tech devices that we have on us, and reclaim the entire object as a space where I could intervene as a creator as well as a user. So, breaking things apart. Opening up, getting rid of the warranty, making my own versions. So in order to inspire people a little bit to do the same thing and start to understand better those devices, I created a set of objects, and these are some of them. This is an MP3 player, and it's basically like a meter-long sock. It's foldable, it's skinnable. You can change the color of the sock. You can remove stuff. And it was made with a mix and match of different techniques, a little bit of hacking, a little bit of stitching, putting the thing together and the circuit. And it actually works. And these are small night lights that were created as an example of how you could mix in both the actual technology, the hardware, the thing that we usually see inside the black box and we don't know what it is, with the physical object. So in this case, it's a translucent kind of polyurethane night light, and the circuit was built like a necklace by hand, almost like a stitched necklace. And so these are two of the objects that I brought with me.
Thank you. We all are embracing technology and love technology, but I think for all of us, as you see here, we all learned the idea of crafting from our mothers, from our grandmothers. And I think it's really important to sort of pay homage to traditional crafts and how over the years and decades and centuries they have evolved. And right now we definitely are seeing the evolution in technology. I want to address this question first to Allison and then to Diana about their grandmothers, because they have great stories of how they influence them in their present work.
Yes. I'd be happy to talk about my... Can you hear me? I'd be happy to talk about my grandmother. My grandmother's name is Alice Merriman. She's a great... Well, was, I guess, a great craftswoman. Lived to 100 years old until last year. Literally sewing, making, crafting, painting until... She was 99 and like 3/4 or say, until she just couldn't do it anymore. And anybody that's ever met her was changed by her. So she definitely had a very large influence in my life. Her idea was, oh, I forgot to say, she does crochet, painting, and this one thing called corn shuckery, which is very specific. It's an old American Indian craft where you take corn shucks and you put them together and you weave them. And you can see this a lot when people do this to the bottom of their chairs. A lot of people use reeds now, but she's one of the original craftswomen that did corn shuckery, and she has a piece in the Smithsonian to represent that artistry. And she was also invited to the World's Fair, I think, a couple of times. And so she's been kind of everywhere, and this is a woman who had the tenacity. She grew up on a farm with no electricity, she had an outhouse, no indoor plumbing. They lived in a very simple time, and they lived like that for a very long time. I don't think my mom had an indoor plumbing until she was like 17 years old. So I certainly have a lot of respect from where she came from. As a crafter, my grandmother did it because my grandfather died, and she was like 55 years old, and she thought, well, now what am I going to do? Because at that point in time, she didn't really have a job. She didn't have the education. She was always a teacher and always someone who always shared her knowledge, but she needed to make some money, so she decided to learn how to paint. She decided, if somebody else can paint, I can paint, and I can paint as good as anyone else. And so she taught herself how to paint, and she started selling like a painting a week. And she taught herself how to do the corn shuckery, and she started teaching other people how to do that, and started selling her little corn shuck dolls and her chairs and her stools that she would buy for, $2 for the stool, and she would get some old corn shucks and borrow them from somebody else and put them all together. So she was extremely resourceful. And her idea was that by keeping her hands busy, it kept your mind busy and kept you thinking about, kept her really positive and social. And this became, people don't probably wouldn't think if you first saw her, this little old lady, she's about as unpretentious as you could possibly ever get in your entire life. They would come to the house, and it became this huge social event. Everybody would sit around. She would talk about her craft. She would talk about what she was making. And she shared it with us, her grandchildren. It was really exciting, and all of us are touched by that, and all do painting or, I mean, all of us do. I can't even tell you how many. My mom doesn't, though, which is a surprise. My mom says she's not creative. That's not true. But anyway, I learned a lot from her attitude. She had a great attitude about sharing and learning and how it just kept your brain free and kept your mind active and how, you know, what she was doing with her life. She was a very simple woman who went really far on just a simple craft. And it heavily influenced me and my ability to believe in myself that I could do something as well.
I just wanted to add really quickly that Natalie and I are also writing a book together. It's called Textile, and it's being published by John Wiley. And it basically teaches how to design fashion with technology. It goes through everything from developing a concept to making and sewing a prototype. But my grandmother also influenced me a lot. She taught me how to sew, and she actually used to sew all of my dad and uncle's clothing. But she was also a math and computer science teacher, and technology and science were very important in our family. We used to have these Thanksgivings where she would invite other mathematicians, and my uncle, who was an electrical engineer, was there, my dad, who was a computer programmer, and we would always talk about what the future was going to be like and what the current technology was. So this was very important because even though I liked to sew and I liked art, it was always very important to look at how technology could fit in with this, because technology was a very important part of the future.
Thank you, Diana. Moving on. So I was always wondering, how do these projects come about? And I want to address this to Susie and Muna. How do you come up with the concepts for your projects, and how do you think about how to incorporate the technology? First, Susie.
You know, for me, technology is just another palette that I use of materials. You know, treat it the same way as I would treat any other materials in my decision-making process and whether I to incorporate it or not. Most of the time, that a lot of my inspiration actually comes with direct experimentation with materials, and sometimes it starts with me tinkering around with a specific circuit. Sometimes it actually starts with me playing around with industrial felt, which is actually my latest obsession. So essentially, that's the one starting point. The other starting point is, as you can tell, some of the projects, I name them. I traditionally, like my undergraduate degree is actually in literature. I write stories. And usually through creating narratives and little stories and making little characters about them, I'm able to sort of create a whole world which will sort of spawn an idea. So it's more fun and sort of playful.
Thank you. Now, Muna, I know you have some slides, so I'm going to...
Yeah, no, you can take a minute. Definitely the storytelling aspect of the object is something that is inspiring and often a starting point, especially for designing. And then once I know there's a specific topic I want to address and there's a specific subject I want to be working with, then I'll often start tackling the materials and the media that I need to work with. So slides are over there. So I just want to walk you through a little bit some of the processes, though, related to being a designer or an artist, someone not trained as an engineer or a technologist, and trying to bring to life some of these ideas. So the first step I usually just describe fairly simply as learning to read. A lot of what I do, and I'm sure a lot of you girls would agree, is spending time deciphering things that are not in a language made for DIY people, made for crafters, made for just kind of even just users and consumers of the product. So it could be a little bit frustrating, but at the same time, understanding it as a language breaks down some of the kind of fear related to engineering and high-level technology, information and knowledge and things like that. So I spend my time in front of data sheets, and the counterbalance to that is a little bit trying to teach people to do that exercise and to reinvent that language in a way that's going to be more familiar to more people, kind of democratizing a little bit that knowledge. Once I get really fed up with trying to understand what the engineer wants to say, then I'll just take something off the shelf and then break it apart. And hacking is also a big part of the way I kind of build and make the prototypes. So if I can't figure it out from one end, then kind of go back to the other end and take something that exists already, break it up, try to understand how it works, reverse engineer it a little bit, and make it do what it needs to do. Because at the end of the day, what will be more important is really the expression of the final object or the final creation that we're able to do. So definitely something I would encourage anyone who wants to try, not to fear breaking things up and trying to see how they can be useful for you. And then through this process of research and really experimenting with the raw material and working directly with it to try to come up with ideas and specific solutions to the problems I want to solve or I want to look at, I start remixing and do what I call remixing the craft. So stitching with hacking, with using super high-tech components or surface mount type of electronic parts that are usually made and designed for machines to use, and trying to find ways to use them ourselves and make them part of the tools we can bring in. So playing around like that with the raw material and bringing in the knitting and the crafting and techniques that are solid and established, I'm able to start building my own conversions of objects. So what you see in the bottom right corner is actually the circuit that I then poured inside that block of polyurethane. And it's a circuit that uses these tiny little surface mount components to which we add beads in order to be able to access them. And that's the kind of techniques that have started to emerge in the field and that a lot of people are using. And it's exciting to share that and see, okay, how is this person solving that problem? How can we work together and build that way? And then the circuit is then kind of created like a necklace rather than like a circuit board. And in that case, poured into a resin. So that would be one example of how playing with the material will bring about the final object and its form. The final slide that I want to show you is for a different project that I don't have here right now, but it's a piece of jewelry. It's a necklace that has a small display on it that will display how many miles away you are from where you're born or where you're from. You can choose a single location. So the premise for the object was kind of this narrative of connection to a remote place and trying to think about whether an electronic device could help us bridge that. But what I want to talk about here is how the process of building it, we knew we wanted to make it in kind of full silver using traditional processes of lost wax. But instead of making the first object by hand, we went kind of the high-tech way and designed the object in 3D as a model of the circuit board that was the actual physical object and printed the 3D model in this plastic using a 3D printer machine. And through that, with that object that became the first artifact, we were able to go back to a more traditional method of fabrication and creation and create the final object with kind of traditional methods. So playing around a little bit with all of these things, mixing them up and see how they kind of can communicate or dialogue with each other to create new forms, basically, or new objects or different narratives.
I like what you said. It's a little bit of hacking and a little bit of stitching. So the next issue I want to raise, we all have heard this, the whole DIY space, do-it-yourself fashion is the new fad. We have successful shows like Project Runway out in mainstream America that, you know, Diana was a part of. And I thought it was very exciting that Diana was representing us in technology as the fashion nerd and bringing out to mainstream America. And at that point is when I wanted to contact her to interview her for Craft. All of the women on the panel have are working in this new industry of fashion technology. And I just want to know, where do you think it's going and who is embracing it better, the fashion industry or the technology industry right now? Diana?
Well, I think that technology is going to be very interesting in fashion because right now the fashion industry isn't doing very well because if you're a designer, H&M will quickly knock you off and can put it in their stores at a much cheaper price. So now what do you do to sell your designer goods since people can buy it more cheaply at H&M, which is where technology comes in handy because people can continue to make luxury items if they put technology in them as the luxury. And we see Prada has been doing this recently. They had a special leather that was two-tone through a more expensive processing technique. And this people couldn't knock this off because the processing technique was expensive, and so it could remain a luxury item. So a lot of kind of high-end designers are actually starting to open research and development labs. Like Versace, I believe they have an R&D lab called Versus. And I think that they're going to be able to fund a lot of research which can help technology become more wearable.
I'm going to actually throw in something else into the mix because you mentioned the engineering perspective, the fashion perspective. I think one thing that's actually missing with this, a lot of the stuff you see, is the interaction perspective. Mm-hmm. And I come from an interaction design background. And before I even got into wearable computing, I was looking at, or just doing work with textiles and electronics, I was looking at, well, how do we interact, or how do we control these textiles, and how do we control these aspects of it? And I think thinking about things like, do we want switches and buttons on our clothes? I personally don't. What about gesture? And looking at other different ways of interaction models and how we actually interact with our clothes and how to control the technology in our clothes and what it does is something else that needs to be thrown into the mix. So I think it has to be a collaborative process, and I think we definitely, both sides have really sort of not looked at the interaction mm-hmm. aspect.
So yeah, I can agree more, actually. I'm trying to remember the original question. Oh, the fashion or the technology side. It just raises more questions. We already have certain theories and understandings of what it means to wear something on your body, what it means, you know, the fashion theory of things, you know, should something be protecting me? Should something be expressing how I'm feeling today, these kinds of things. So whenever you add technology and add interaction to what you're doing, it becomes a very layered, somewhat sometimes complicated, process. It becomes very complicated. And I just want to say that I do see fashion technology moving forward, and then definitely in the next 10 years. When I started in 2001, 2002, and we first started learning about this stuff, there was nothing. It was very difficult to find. But now research labs have popped up all over, ExtraSoft labs in Canada. I can't even think of all of them right now. Of course, MIT has been doing this for a long time. Of course, the aesthetics of MIT have now greatly improved because women crafters have gone there and decided that we no longer want to look like walking cyborgs all the time. Not there's anything wrong with that. I'm sorry. Not there's anything wrong with that. It just, like, I feel like there needs to be the technology people. We have technology people and we have fashion people, right? We have two industries. And they speak two different languages, right? We have the fashion. We're dealing with all of the basis of fashion theory, what we wear, what it means, the color, expression, you know, textiles, and all of this sort of thing. And on the technology side, I'll let you keep. You can interrupt me if you want.
Yeah, no.
On the technology side, it also moves much slower. Fashion, you know, turns around like this, and technology is very fast. On technology side, they often forget about the aesthetics, and they throw it in later on. This is changing a lot. But they definitely need to have a conversation. They don't use the same language. One of the struggles a lot of us had when we're putting these things together is, what language do we do when we speak about something? When you say something's an LED, do you say, LED is like a little clear bead with got two legs on it? I mean, that sounds different to me as a crafter than, it's a little light. Okay, you know.
Or it's a diode.
Or it's a diode that the current goes through one side. But that's great. And I learned that, and I love technology. But it's a different language. And so it comes all about, at that point, about language and getting them together to see what the possibilities are. And there's a lot of collaborative efforts, like with Hussein Shaolin. Balenciaga came out with something. What was it? Some crazy pants last year. Sometimes it just has to do with aesthetics, you know, it gets people excited. The tech aesthetics.
I didn't talk about that yet. Oh my God, it's all disappeared. It's actually going to reappear. So I was supposed to talk a bit about the collaboration I did with a fashion designer called Angel Cheng, who's been trying to really come from the fashion side of things and bring in the technology. And it's been a very humbling experience to see her with this drive to bring a product on the market, on the high-end fashion and couture market, and calling us in with a specific expertise on a material or a texture. So in that case, I'd been working with some people with these thermochromic inks that change colors with heat. And we were controlling them electrically. We were kind of bringing in a lot of tech in it into how to use them and the narratives of these inks. And Angel came along and said, I love the inks and I want to work with you in trying to bring them into the clothing. But if we want to make it happen in the real world, we have to strip down the technology a lot and bring it to the bare minimum. And in that case, just work with the raw material of the ink. So if anyone wants to, at the end, kind of play around.
I'm going
to
speak a little more on that. This is often a topic of conversation in my class, as she's showing us.
This is the first piece.
Oh, this is great.
Yeah, this is the first piece we did with Angel, which is a kind of tunic dress of her first spring collection. And as you wear it close to your body, or you move from one space to the other, from outside to inside in the summer, the print will change color from orange, in that case, to yellow. A little bit like the scarf, which I hadn't noticed. I thought I was still kind of flashy orange, but I was actually getting white because of the heat of my body was changing color.
We talked about this earlier. I think a lot of it's going to happen from the manufacturing side. There's some really great things to... it's just difficult, like they're saying, to integrate right now the electronics into it, basically at the in the manufacturing level. And we talked about this earlier about you're talking about printed batteries and, you know, making... Say it. Go ahead and say what you want everything to be.
Oh, yes. My dream is for things to be washable, which I think can happen in the next 10 years.
Yes.
But right now it's not very wearable because it's... Sometimes the electronics are hard, they're not washable, they break easily.
They wear down. So there's definite challenges, but I can guarantee you, and most of us will in 10 years, that a lot of those challenges are being met through like a collaborative experience, I guess, through the corporations.
So, and I also think that in terms of fashion, the technology is going to be more aesthetic, but like you guys were saying, very interaction-based, so it's kind of going to be your interactions which are going to govern how the clothing looks. Because, I mean, fashion is just a very social, aesthetic thing. So in terms of fashion and technology, I don't think it's ever going to be about functionality. But for medical devices or for military, it would be functional.
Yeah, we didn't talk about that, did we? Oh, yeah, they've got a lot of advances in medical and military. I think most people can find that. I worked on a project. I don't even know if I'm allowed to talk about this. Anyway, I worked on a project. I'll find out soon enough. I worked on a project where they're developing basically an advanced suit for the... Okay, basically, you need to know what's going on with your soldiers out there, right? Are they dehydrated? Are they hurt? And they need to know it from a remote location. So there's definitely a lot of research in that area, and it's extremely advanced. You guys would be very impressed to know that. Our government's working hard in that area.
And there are also some products you can buy right now. If you want to buy heated clothing, there's a lot of hunting gear out there. So, yeah, but I mean, you kind of have to go into the specialty markets to look for it. It's not fashion related yet.
The sports industry is embracing this like rapid fire. Mm-hmm. The thing, I'm going to bring up the Nike shoe thing because the thing that I'm interested in this is the fact that not only once your clothing has it has technology embedded into it, your clothing can become networked and it becomes another means of communication, expression, which is what fashion is inherently anyway. It's a means of self-expression. So it opens up a whole other plethora, but I think it's a whole other topic discussion, so we can stop there.
So you can see on the panel, a lot of these women wear many different hats. They're designers, they're technologists, they're crafters, and some of them are also teachers. And so I want to ask, why is it so important for you to teach as well as, you know, create your own projects and share them as well? Muna, did you want to start with that?
Pay the bill. No, a lot of the knowledge that is not being developed by the military, but by the people who are doing stuff, is really emerging in that environment of open source and shared knowledge and shared information and techniques and putting stuff out there. So from my perspective, since the beginning, it's really been about participating in that discussion and giving back, in a way, the little things that I pick up to the same community that has allowed me to learn and move forward in the different steps and stages. And the workshops are a lot of fun. The teaching is fun because it's more of that collaboration and exchange of idea and just working with that material. It's not a lot of money and it's not a big kind of corporate research lab that has the means to move things forward. So if we don't get organized and really work together to start generating innovative ways and means and techniques and things that speak to us, then it's not going to happen in our corners alone.
Yeah, I agree. I tend to teach workshops. One is because I want to meet other people interested in the stuff, but also I want to meet more people who are better at either sewing or better at technology or better at conceptually. They're artists. For me, this stuff is very complicated. It's a merging of a lot of different areas, from technology to fashion to making, you know, and it's a very collaborative process. And in order to work on a larger scale beyond making finger puppets, I think collaboration. And the best way to do it is just to start teaching. Also, I teach work with kids. I teach a robotics class to kids. And that is really inspirational, too, because a lot of these kids ask you questions that adults would never ask you. And through those asking those types of questions, that it forces me to sort of really think out of what I'm personally accustomed to and make things slightly differently. And also, like...
Can you give us an example of an experience of what a child has asked you?
Well, essentially, I was... initially, a lot of the concepts came out because I was working with the Lego Mindstorms to teach how to build robots. And some of the girls in there wanted to figure out if they could build something else outside of a robot with the stuff. And all I had been so mentally trained that to use these tools, I have to teach these kids how to build battle bots that crash and, you know, race each other at the end of my class day. Because that's what we were... that's really the intention of the product. And so it forced me to, like, spend a week in trying to figure out... Look at the technology and figure out different things that some of these other kids could do. You know, maybe we can make draw bots, which other people had done. But also, you know, to really exploit... There's a communication system, actually. We can email programs to each other to change the behaviors in Lego Mindstorms. It really forced me to exploit that aspect of it to engage some of the more female demographics that I never did before, mm-hmm. You know? So it forced me to come up with new projects and a new way of actually organizing the class. And I actually did a couple of classes that nobody was allowed to build a battle bot, you know? And so that's really there.
Yeah. For me, grandmother's teacher, mom's a teacher, just kind of came in there. I never thought I'd ever do it, ever. I didn't even want to do it. Then I did it one day after one semester, and it kind of like changed me forever. And I realized the inspiration that others bring to you and that you can bring to others. And I think that's what a lot of crafting is about. We really like to share. I mean, we get into knitting circles. I hate to say it, I don't knit, but I can sew, okay? So I can get into, like, sewing circles. I'm sorry. My mom would be very depressed. But it's a very social activity, and it's all about, you know, there's a lot of sharing that's involved. I get with my students, and my students are grad students, most of them, and they come in with the most diverse backgrounds, you know, from illustrators to, I think I had one that was like an accountant to... I mean, just everything from every background. And I show them a couple little skills, and they're like, they'll go out and find something. I'm like, wow, I've never looked at it that way before. And so they just bring such a unique perspective. And it challenges me every day again to focus on my language and making sure that I'm able to communicate to them what they can do, you know? Because when you deal with such a diverse background, that's, again, what it becomes mostly about, again, is language. And I push that a lot, I know, but it's true for me and my experience. So for me, it's so rewarding, and I think it's rewarding for them as well. A lot of them, Alice Planis, I don't know, she came up with like these sparkle, really cool sparkle jewelries. We had about five students go to Ars Electronica last year from the class. I mean, they are doing, I'm normally taken back by my students. They're just doing amazing work, and it's well over to ITP, so I have to tell you.
So, a lot of us have different backgrounds. My background is actually, I was a web designer, mostly doing flash design, and kind of came into this field. And the question I want to ask is, so what kind of advice would you give to someone who wants to start with tech crafts or wants to start with fashion technology? How can they get started? Diana, do you want to start?
Okay, I think they should start by looking on the internet because there are a lot of really great tutorials about how to sew with conductive thread and just kind of, I don't know, how to integrate circuits. I think Instructables is a really great site for that, and also Craft Magazine has...
Craftscene.com.
Yeah. Or start with deciding what you want to do and a very specific project and not thinking at all about how you're going to make it happen and just kind of bring that idea and then break it up into all its different components and tackling the experience and the knowledge required for each one of these components. We often tell our students that you're not going to learn everything, but you're going to become a specialist in the one thing you need in one specific moment in time. Things move so fast, we can't keep up. I can barely really, you know, keep up with anything that's going on. So we go one project at a time. What's the objective? What's the project you want to make happen? Why do you want to do it? And then it becomes much easier.
I actually have addressed this issue. We have something called a fashion hack. And
we throw them on. They're like little parties that we do at Parsons every so often. And either they're 1 or 2 day workshops, and you don't have to come to the workshop, but I'll tell you what we do. You go out and you buy a cheap toy. It's like $5, right? Make sure you get a really cheap one, because the more expensive ones are harder to hack into. You know, like a little kid's toy that you can play music on, or something that vibrates, and, you know, kind of stay, I normally tell people to stay away from motors the very first time they're doing it, and just work with sound, vibration, or like blinking lights. Tear it apart and force yourself to put it on some piece of clothing that you already have in a unique way. They come up with the craziest things. We have a jacket with like a boom box on it, and you can like hit beatbox and you can like play music. But they, you know, it's just at that point in time, you break down that fear. You know, it's like, so what if it doesn't look good? Yeah, it does. It's not going to look good the first time, right? So, you know, you just throw them in there, let them make something, see what happens. And that's kind of what I've been doing. But yes, the internet also is a very good resource if you can't do a fashion hack. But do a fashion hack on your own. I mean,
I think you need to collaborate with people. I think you need to do, because the best way to learn is for learning from other people, watching other people. That's the way I've definitely learned, you know. Even when I work with my seamstress occasionally for some projects, like I learned how to sew through her, or sew better through her. I like to work with other artists so I can conceptually develop, you know, ideas further beyond what I usually do. And I like to work with, I love to work with engineers because they can actually make things really work consistently all the time. So, that's
it. That's very cool. Excellent. We have a knitter in the first row.
Yeah. I've been enjoying watching that.
So, looking forward into the future, I always like to look in that crystal ball. Let's look into the next 10 years. What are your hopes into how this tech craft world, fashion technology world is going to evolve into, and what kind of space would you like it to be? Muna, do you want to start?
I'm going to start.
You're going to start? Okay.
You know how much I don't like this question. So I'm just going to get it over with. 10 years from now, anything can happen. That's my first response. And I know that's a lousy response, but I really hope things become more socially based. I mean, they're already starting to happen that way. And some of the things that we experience to meet each other and the relationships that we develop online can now be developed through our clothing and our experiences in person, which is so nice. Or it's already happening, though, with hug jackets. You know, you hug your friend and 10,000 miles away, your friend feels your hug and these kinds of things. So I'm very much a romantic, and I'm looking forward to having more technologies integrated into the social aspects of our lives.
Thank you. Muna?
Sure. I mean, I think in the next 10 years, we still have to ask the question, what do we want and why do we want it there? And in that sense, the vision I'd like to see is for products, not only fashion products, but just technology products that could become the product of a collaboration between the users and the people who are actually consuming the objects and the people who are making them. Both a dialogue in terms of what the needs are, as well as a dialogue in terms of how it's made. Right now, you have the stuff that's ready-made. You can buy off the shelf, or you can buy the version that's been done by a crafter. But maybe it'd be interesting to start thinking about products that are a combo, that are designed or manufactured in a certain way, but that could be modified or adjusted or reused, and that have more of a mentality of these kinds of more sophisticated life cycles for the products and the objects we create than just kind of, okay, one idea, put it out on the market, it's going to die in 3 years, it doesn't matter. We'll just kind of keep moving forward into sometimes just void.
That's really interesting, because you're talking about the like kind of the history and the lifespan of something over time.
Definitely.
That would be interesting to see happen.
I was just going to add to that. I think what she's talking about is exactly right, because I think what you're talking about is breaking down the consumer-producer paradigm. And I think the next step or level of craft is really, it's like happening now, is going into the whole 3D fabrication stuff. Mm-hmm. The fabrications technologies. Once we all have 3D printers in our, you know, in our houses the same way, or laser cutters and all these, you know, like 3D fab machines, what is that going to be? How is craft going to evolve once we have access to more and more digital as well 3D modeling technologies? In the future, we're going to see craft. We'll be able to etch our own circuit boards, and craft will look very, very different than what it is today. And that's sort of where I see it going. And similarly to what you're talking about is, you know, the breaking down of these consumer-producer sort of paradigms. We have crafters now produce culture. You know, they make it. We're on the web. We're sharing it. We're disseminating it. You know, the whole paradigm, the way things are manufactured and disseminated, isn't top down anymore. And that's the sort of exciting part that's happening, and I think it's only going to become more object-based and easier and more a little bit more mass-producible. I mean, with these 3D fabrication stuff, you're not going to just make one. You can easily make more 10, 20, 50, 100 at a time. So.
And the move into craft away from DIY. I mean, the topic of this talk was bringing both together, but I actually believe they're very different. And the DIY brings a limitation in terms of how far you can go or how sophisticated you can make something. And the craft brings in a whole other array of understanding and knowledge, and the idea that there's actually some sorts of kind of a series of techniques that need to be applied and brought on board rather than just let's slap it together and make something very simple.
We were talking about that earlier, actually, the whole idea of craft and what it means. And what it means to me is the quality in which you make something and whatever that is. What were we saying?
Well,
we were talking about the home ec aspect.
Yeah, I think we were actually just talking about the word craft has lots of its meaning. I mean, back in the day, craft meant, you know, anything from woodworking to sewing, and there was a lot of workmanship and artisanal skills into it. I mean, actually, the French word for craft just basically means artisan. And something happened there. Maybe it was in the 70s. Maybe it was too much, you know, tie-dye and macrame, but the idea of craft got lost, and the word had a bad connotation. It became this idea of, oh, we were talking about, you know, basically Project Runway. I'm a big fan. And Michael Kors always, you know, comments, oh, if someone's outfit, you know, wasn't designed well, he would say, it looks too crafty. It's a little home ec. And, you know, what is, you know, the meaning of the word needs to come back. And hopefully, I think we're all trying to bring back the idea of it's the art of making something.
And I mean, I think that in a way it's already there, but we don't realize it. Like Martha Stewart, her, you know, she's a very successful crafter, but most of her crafts are designed using the same design process that designers use, and the crafts are actually designed by designers, and she creates mood boards and has color stories for them. So, you know, I kind of hope that one day the lines between craft and design are really going to fade away, and I think that what you're saying with the rapid prototyping and having your own 3D printer can really help to make the at-home crafter a designer and be able to distribute their own products.
So I hope we gave you a great overview into this new world of high-tech craft. I just want to first thank all the women for being on the panel, and Muna, who almost couldn't make her flight because of a storm, for being here. So let's give a round of applause to everyone here, and then we'll have to do Q&A.
Thank you, Natalie.
So now we want to hear from you. And if you have a question you'd like to ask any of the panelists, please step up. There's mics in the middle over there. And go ahead and step up to the mic. And
come on up, Berta style.
You can. So everyone can hear the question.
Yeah, actually, I have a comment to make, but maybe you can comment on that comment. And that's... how much can fashion learn from technology? I mean, what we did at Berta Style, for you that don't know, Berta Style is an open source sewing platform. You can download PDF clothing patterns, print them at home or whatever. And I liked your talk about collaboration. And what we think is that technology, the mindset and the culture of technology, of using open source as a philosophy where you cooperate and where you share your knowledge. This is something where fashion and probably other craft can learn as well, and where you share your knowledge. And I like what you guys said, and maybe you can give some more examples of that, how that works. I mean, on our side, we have picture tutorials as users upload, and it's similar to Instructables, that she teach you techniques. If you don't have your grandmother like Allison that welcomes you in your living room, you know, you can go to the web and learn it there. But maybe you can say a bit more on your stand on open source and sharing design. That's something that I'm specifically interested on. All the design on our side and our patterns is copyright free, so designers can use it, can use our patterns and actually sew and sell and use them commercially. And I was just wondering, what's your stand on this?
I'm going to make a quick comment to that. First of all, there's so many things. Craft, there's a lot of history to craft, and I don't know where to start. But basically,
Craft is a lot of times about open source, and it always has been. And they have the same goals as well as a lot of open source systems on the internet. I'm not sure. I'm having a hard time understanding what the question is. Maybe do you feel that they're too separate at this point? That they're not learning from each other, the craft and the technology? Oh, design is so close. Well, that's definitely changing.
Yeah, I actually...
Yeah, I think...
I was going to say, I actually feel like the fashion industry is very interrelated. There are actually no copyrights on any of the fashion designs, and even though we often use the word knockoff, it's kind of a commonly respected thing in the industry. They call it shopping copy, where they'll go and they'll buy other designs and they'll just send it exactly as is and have it copied and in their line. But in a way, if you feel like this jacket that's being copied represents what your vision is for your collection, then it's perfectly okay to use. And, it's pretty acceptable. It's not really thought of in a bad way. A lot of people in the industry also use trend forecasters, and the trend forecasters will talk about general shapes and silhouettes for two seasons ahead of time. So, everyone is sort of looking at the same information during their developmental process, and a lot of the fashion designers are pretty close friends and will talk to each other and give each other feedback on what they're working on. The whole fashion industry is actually in about this 4-block area, so you kind of know everybody, and all the design studios are very close together.
But I would have to agree, though, there is a culture, a closed culture to the design world and kind of an obsession to protect your idea. I'll answer shortly, but there's a kind of super basic saying in the open source world that I learned is the scratch your own itch as one of the motivations for people to embark on the field of open source and start developing software for that. So I do believe it's still a question of finding your own interest in doing that. And as long as the fashion industry doesn't see how it could be something rewarding and positive that will help it move forward, then there's no real incentive for it, for them to kind of go in that direction.
I really disagree, because I think a lot of fashion designers do work together to create a style. Like right now, the hipster movement is kind of big, and you see clothes like this at Urban Outfitters, but it wasn't a style that was created by only one person. It was actually created in an area of Brooklyn called Williamsburg, and people started doing it because they would get together and they would alter their clothing together to make it this hipster style. And so it was developed by the whole community of people kind of working together to make their clothing and then wearing it out to different parties and things. So I think it's a fairly collaborative process, but it's more...
All right.
Yeah. It's more location-based. It's not... Fashion designers don't use technology as well as they could, so it's not really open to everyone on the internet. And that would probably be an improvement. But.
Okay, next question, please.
Yeah, thanks. Basically, as a quilter, we look at crafting as history. And, we're talking about quilts meaning things 100 years from now. What I'm interested is, how much do you think the new technology is going to be there in 100 years, and how much of that is going to reflect our current culture?
First off, that's a great question. Here's a craft magazine for you.
Like fashion, one of the things, the best way to look at a culture is to look at their fashion. Anybody that studies fashion theory knows that. You can always look and understand what was going on in society by what they were wearing, hence women in corsets and whatnot. One of the things, I do love quilting, actually. I haven't done it in a while simply because of all of this. But I do think that it's something we need to think more about is history. It's a matter at that point in time that our technology is going to change so much. In 100 years from now, it's going to be completely different. But this will still, they'll be like, oh my God, I can't believe they used that silly little circuit. Look how big and huge that thing is. I can't believe it's not integrated in already. It still speaks for the time in which it came from. It doesn't disappear. Unless, but we have other problems like battery power. You might not be able to get the same battery 100 years from now, things of that nature. So there's definite constraints, but I still think as objects of history, they're still extremely relevant, and they do tell a story of our time today.
I just want to add something too, and I think a lot of the technology we're seeing is very high tech here. Obviously, there's also lower technology. We have digital cameras. We have inkjet printers. They can print onto fabric. We actually had a project in a previous issue of a quilt a crafter made, Susan Beale, for her wedding anniversary, and had photos of her and her husband at their wedding. And she used technology to create an heirloom quilt. And I think, you know, like Allison said, technology is part of our daily lives and part of our time right now, but we're using it in a way that is telling the story of the time now. So I would hope 100 years from now, you know, when Susan's great-great-great-granddaughter sees it and sees, oh my God, she, you know, I'm sure there's going to be something crazy that you can just like, you know, Minority Report, it's like printing from the sky or something, that, you know, she's going to be like, wow, she created this from her hand and this was made obviously with love, you know? Telling a story about her marriage.
There's actually a cool interview. I hate to plug Switch, but it's coming up next week. And it's by Brother. And they do this really cool thing called Photo Stitch. You guys all know that. So how advanced Brother is in technology, the Brother sewing machines, for those who don't know. It's incredible what they do. And one of the things with Photo Stitch is you take your USB and you plug it in, you put in a picture of your friend or your family, and it automatically can stitch. Tells you what to do, tells you how many stitches, how many colors, and it stitches that image out for you. So there's a lot of manufacturers thinking about that as well, you know, what it means for us. I just want them to see, you know, I just want to be able to throw a t-shirt in though, like my boyfriend's t-shirt, my t-shirt, my mom's t-shirt, and pop me out a quilt or something like that. You know, I haven't seen that yet. We'll have to work on that.
I think technology and craft have historically been related. I mean, you didn't hand sew your quilt. You made on a sewing machine. A sewing machine is technology. You know, people who blacksmith and all these things are.
There's looms. Yeah. Weaving a loom.
Yeah, and this is just another material. I think, you know, it just, as I was saying before, technology does certain things that enhances certain qualities of the story I'm telling. The story doesn't change. These finger puppets would be just as much fun without, you know, they'd be different, slightly different, but they still exude the story of these are quirky little guys that do something because of the actual form making of it.
Right. Okay, so we have one more minute. We just want to ask your question, sir.
Okay, hopefully a quick question. Looking at this, this is being treated right now as a do-it-yourself sort of thing, the crafting of these fabrics and stuff. But even when you're doing do-it-yourself projects, there's the availability of materials, I guess. My question is there any companies that you know of that are making things that are sort of bridging the between technology and fashion? So instead of just having to take an LED, you might have a button that has an LED already on it or anything like that? Is there
no. So it's well, just do it there's yourself? Places that we get things from. We've had to learn to be extremely resourceful and look at things differently. That's one of the things that's going on right now. There's like Less EMF and what is it? Spark? What's not Spark Lab?
But
you can get the fabrics. Spark Fun. Thank you. Spark Fun, where you can get like electronic thread and electronic pieces like that.
But the Lily Pads, right?
And Lily Pad by Leah Beakley.
So there's people who are starting to understand there's an industry
starting
all of this work and trying to target us basically in making ready-made things that could be plug and play. Mm-hmm. The Lily Pad, the Arduino, the work of Leah Beakley, and she's coming up with a whole line of tools so to bridge that gap and can bring it to more people.
But no, we don't have machine sewable LEDs yet. So anyone want to manufacture a new package? It can't be that hard.
They do make LEDs that that are flat with little holes on the edge. So
So we're out of time. Thank you everyone for coming. If you guys want to come up and ask any questions to anyone here, feel free. And we also have some craft magazines to pass out. Thank you.